Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, hello, everyone. Chuck and Julie, Chuck Bonneville, Julie Hayden, Truth Straight Up, as always. And it's brought to you by
AmericanCitizenPress.com, great conservative website, and Denver Cenogenics and Dr. Julie McCallan. A lot is always going on today. We're going to have Dr. John Lott Jr. coming up here in a second. Has some new and pretty interesting research regarding the 2020 election, certainly raising questions. And then also coming up at 3:30, we're going to have Jimmy Mack, who is one of the counters. We had a very successful CD8 assembly over the weekend. Huge congratulations to Anil Mathai. It was first one ever because it's a new congressional district. It was great turnout. All the people we wanted won. So,
Laurie Sane won, and she beat Jules Gray. And Jules, I thought, did a great job of presenting herself and then. But she didn't quite get enough to make the 30% threshold.
Uh-huh.
But it was a robust turnout and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of election integrity on how everything was carried out.
Right, that's what I wanted to talk to Jimmy about, because you may or may not know there's the state assembly is coming up on Saturday, and there are some people pushing to not have Dominion machines counted, which I don't think they were going to anyway.
But they're gonna have clickers.
But do I have a paper ballot? And that's what they did here at CD8. Wanted to talk to Jimmy about how that went. And again, Anil was extremely organized, right? We had no voter fraud, no illegal. The first ballot, there was a little bit of an issue with like four out of hundreds, right? And then after that, people were like, oh, I guess I better pay attention to how to vote, what the rules are. And they did, and it went just fine.
Well, I'm not sure people knew the rules, so they could have been explained a little better.
Okay, and then we're also going to have Pat Cage talk. Now, you may, if you read the Denver Post and you listen to any of the corporate media, think that there are no questions about the 2020 election. And if you have those questions, just like the climate, just like the Hunter Biden laptop, just like the Russia hoax, you are a denier. You're a denier.
Election denier.
Well, those old election deniers, Pat Cage and that group of people who actually are asking legitimate questions are having a debate. And Peg's going to bring us up to date on that. But that's just one of the things I want to talk about with Dr. John Lott. I mean, you hear so much. The Denver Post had a big story, a bunch of clerk and recorders from across the country, coincidentally, many of them Democrats, held the news conference yesterday because there is going to be a news conference and a rally talking about the election. And they said that they wanted to put on record that the election deniers are crazy and no one is allowed to ask questions about the election.
All right. Well, we've got John Lott Jr. on us in line three. John, welcome to the program again. Great to hear from you.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, let me real quick, John, you know, he's a researcher, he's a columnist, he's got a great book out, we've talked to him about that before, Gun Control Myths. He runs the Crime Prevention Research Center. He had a great study that was published in Public Choice, and I'm just going to let you explain it, John, and this was in the Washington Times, was where we read this story too.
Either that or Examiner, I'm not sure.
But anyway, John, why don't you explain what you were looking into regarding the 2020
and what
election
you found out.
And what you found.
Sure. Well, just from my own background, I've been an academic most of my life. I've had positions at the Wharton Business School, University of Chicago, Stanford, Yale. And most of my academic research has actually been on voting and vote fraud and voting machines and stuff. I've published several dozen peer-reviewed papers in that area.
Okay.
And I was working at the U.S. Department of Justice when the election occurred, and given my background, it kind of made sense that I would look at this issue. Now, one of the big problems, people hear about all the court cases that are there, but the court cases really never looked at the issue of illegality or fraud. What happened was, is Republicans would go in and say, look, the election laws were broken, and the judges extremely often would say, yeah, you know, there were problems with it, But if we're going to do anything about it, you have to show us up front that there was enough fraud that would go and change the outcome of the election.
Yes.
And so what happened was the Republicans would respond by saying, well, we weren't allowed to observe very well what was going on with the vote counts. There were lots of problems with that, too. And so we're going to need to have discovery in order to make our case there. And the judges would say, look, we're not going to grant discovery. We're not going to go down this road unless you can show us up front that there was enough fraud to go and change the election. And, you know, there are other issues there, too. But so Republicans were kind of caught in a catch-22. And so what I tried to do is to think up empirical tests that could get a measure of the amount of problems that were occurring with the votes. And there's, in this peer-reviewed paper that's forthcoming in Public Choice, and people can get a copy of it to look at it at our website at crimeresearch.org, I offer three tests for it. The first two are very similar. You have some counties where fraud was alleged, and they're right next to other counties where nobody's making any allegations that fraud has occurred. Now, one of the problems with comparing full counties is that there are lots of things that vary across a county. If you're looking at Fulton County in Georgia versus, let's say, Cherokee County, which is next door, there are huge differences in the demographic makeup as you move across Fulton County. They can make it very different from a neighboring county that's there in terms of the type of people who may want to turn out, the type of people you may want to focus on in terms of get out the vote. And the same thing, let's say, for Allegheny County, which is Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. You have Allegheny County right next to a county like Westmoreland. So what I wanted to do was, rather than compare the whole counties, was to look at individual precincts that are right on the border, that are right across the street from a precinct in the county where there's no allegations being made. And, you know, so for Allegheny County in Pennsylvania, you have 1,323 precincts. So you're talking about very small geographic areas that are just right across the street from other really small geographic areas. And what you find is that in 2016, these areas tended to vote essentially the same. I mean, you're talking about a percentage point difference in terms of who they voted for and either the in-person votes or the absentee ballots that were there. They're very similar in terms of demographics and income and other things. I mean, you could literally walk across the street in most of these places and you'd have no idea that you had just walked from one county to another. And and so what I wanted to do was to see not just what happened in the 2016 election, but then to go and look at the 2020 election. What you find is that, again, the in-person votes tend to be very similar, extremely similar. But the absentee votes in the county where fraud was alleged, because it's the in-person votes are counted at the precinct level. The absentee ballots are counted centrally. You see a huge difference. You walk across the county. And so, you know, the issue is, well, you know, maybe they just had some get-out-the-vote effort. But the thing, these are statewide elections. If you have two precincts that are literally across the street from each other, two small, tiny, homogeneous areas that are extremely similar in how they vote and how they're registered and their demographics, you know, if there's certain types of people, they're going to respond to get out the vote. And if, let's say, Democrats don't want to vote in person, they're more likely to want to vote by mail. Well, you know, presumably that's going to be Democrats on both sides of the street.
Right.
There.
Right.
And so that's not going to explain it. And then I also looked at provisional ballots, and this was extremely strong evidence, I thought, that there were, in Pennsylvania, there were allegations that certain counties, when people would send in absentee or mail-in ballots, they hadn't properly filled things out, like they hadn't signed the outside of the envelope, for example, and therefore the vote couldn't be counted. And the allegation was is that in these heavily Democratic counties, they would go and when people made mistakes, they would be called up and asked to fix them. If they were Democrats, Democrat voters, people who were registered as Democrats would get calls and be asked to fix it. And the problem is when you look across the street in Republican counties, even though the precinct right across the street is essentially identical in terms of being Democrats or what have you, those counties didn't make those calls. And the reason why they didn't make those calls, and nobody's alleging that they did, was because it's against the law for these election officials to call up these people to give them a second chance to vote. And it's particularly wrong if they just called up people,
Democrats.
Like if the Republicans only called up Republicans, and it's
right.
true that the Democrats only called up Democrats to try to get these fixed. And so what you find...
What law that did just, that specifically violate? Because I know here in Colorado...
State law in Pennsylvania.
Oh. Okay.
In Denver, that's exactly what they do. They care. Now, they may even call Republicans, but the fact that, you know, the Republicans are only 15%, if you called 100
right,
people,
sure.
85 would be Democrats. There are no
right.
counties that are majority Republicans in Colorado that call you up to tell you your ballot is flawed in some manner.
Right.
And yet that's almost never brought up because, let's face it.
Because you're a denier.
Yeah,
if you're denying it.
But because you have a media that's totally controlled by the left in Colorado.
Well, it's mainstream media seems to be controlled pretty much in general right now.
Right.
I'm not wanting to talk about this stuff.
So anyway,
if you look at Allegheny County and Philadelphia counties, two of the counties, just for provisional votes, you find almost 7,000 more votes for Biden just from that one type of ballot, just from those two counties.
Right.
And and then the third test that I looked at was to try to see what happened to voter turnout. What you find is that, if you have ineligible people voting, or you have vote buying, or you have other similar types of issues, you may get more people voting than you have votes, than you should have. And
right.
so the turnout will be higher. And so I looked at all the turnout rates by county in mm-hmm. The nine swing states.
Okay.
And what you found was that... generally, more Democratic counties had no change or even a slight drop in turnout relative to 2016, except for the counties where fraud was alleged. And in those counties, you had huge increases in turnout, 25-30% over what it was in the previous presidential election. And, you have counties like in Ohio, which was a swing state, like you have counties like Franklin County, where Columbus is, or the counties for Cincinnati or Cleveland, and you could compare them to counties in Pennsylvania, like Allegheny County, or in Michigan, like Wayne County, where Detroit is. You would think this is a state that Democrats and Republicans are battling over. Shouldn't you expect to see a big increase in turnout there, too? And yet you don't. Or you can look at Fulton County and compare it to Mecklenburg or, Dade County in Florida or Broward or whatever. And it's just in those counties where fraud was alleged that you see these huge increases in turnout.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That kind of matches with some of the stuff that, and we'll be talking about that later, if not today, then on Wednesday, that True the Vote was finding regarding sort of the ballot traffickers. So bottom line, what you found is when you look at precincts that are essentially right across the street from each other, so you're talking the same demographics. Coincidentally, when you look at the mail, that the vote in person was pretty much the same as 2016, but the mail-in ballots was significant, like 20-30% higher suddenly. And when you look at the counties, you're saying where there was fraud alleged, and all the rest of the state, things were pretty much similar with what you would expect. But in the counties where fraud was alleged, obviously
right,
you had
in terms of the turnout, right? You had this
right,
big
you had this significant issue.
So what do your detractors say?
Well, you're a denier, John. You're a denier. We've already proven, just like the Hunter Biden laptop, that this is not true. So
what are your detractors say is wrong with your analysis?
Right. Well, I just got a paper by a couple people that are looking at it, and they claim that they don't get any differences in turnout. They claim that they ran the exact same specification that I did. I reran it this morning, and I get the same results, so I have no idea. I mean, they got the data from me. They even thanked me on the front page for giving it to them the very day that they asked for it. And but if they had trouble replicating my work, they could have... they could have called me up or talked to me about it. Just like I gave them the data, I'd be happy to talk to them about it. But I didn't hear anything from them. And I make the data available to anybody who wants to look at it. And so others can go and check what I've done.
The way you're doing it, because I think one of the mistakes, and we'll talk about this again either later today or tomorrow, that Republicans made initially... although I think the Democrats were going to try to destroy anybody who questioned the election anyway. But I think you're just saying, hey, these are the facts. You're not saying...
Look, let me make one thing clear. I'm not trying to relitigate the 2020 election.
Right.
I don't think that that's going to be productive at this stage. My concern is trying to deal with future elections and to make sure that the types of problems that we had in the 2020 election don't reappear. And,
well, that's the whole point.
Lots more states, Illinois and California, have moved to mail-in ballots. Colorado has mail-in ballots. You have some real issues there. And one of the things I do at the beginning of the paper, which I really haven't had anybody respond to or deal with at all, is to look at the international data on how other countries have anti-fraud rules, because lots of them used to have rules similar to the United States, but they experienced a large amount of fraud, and so they became very restrictive. So you look at Europe, for example. There are 47 countries in Europe. I point out in the paper, 46.5 of them require government-issued photo IDs for people to be able to go and vote. The one exception is part of the United Kingdom, but even now they are moving to be like the rest of the continent that's there. And you look at absentee ballots. 35 of the 47 countries in Europe completely banned absentee ballots because of concerns about fraud and vote buying. Another 10 allow absentee ballots, but they will not send them in the mail because they're worried about the ballots being stolen. They require that you have to come in person to go and pick them up, and you have to go and show a government-issued photo ID for you to be able to go and pick it up. And 6 of those 10 countries will also only limit it to people who are in the military or in the hospital at the time of the election. You look at Europe. You look at other countries. You look at our neighbors, Mexico and Canada. Both require government-issued photo IDs.
Mexico, well, they have more than that. I lived in Mexico for a while, and I knew the mayor and everyone. So they did me the honor, I guess, of being able to monitor the election there. And there was a big election, very hotly contested. But what was shocking about what they do is that not only require a photo government-issued photo ID. Well, they also have your picture. They're looking at that picture and comparing it to the picture in your photo ID. They're not going to just say, you're John Jones, and say, here's my fraudulent ID with my picture. They look at that, wait a minute.
Like your vaccine card.
Yeah, John Jones is 98 and you're 12.
Right, no, right. They look at your picture and they have your thumbprint there.
Yeah, right. That too, because you have to put that down.
Right. Well, John, what do you think is, and now you may not want to go here because, I think what's so important is to just get these facts out, because like you say, they'll all say there's no evidence, no evidence, no evidence. And I've been comparing it to like the Leslie Stahl Donald Trump interview where he kept trying to talk to her about the evidence with the Hunter Biden laptop. And she said, we can't talk about it because there's no evidence. And he'd say, well, let me show you the evidence.
She said it wasn't verified.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't. But in something like this, I understand if you don't want to go here, but let me ask you this. What do you theorize was going on? What were the factors, do you think, that led to there being so many more, such a much higher turnout in the counties and the precincts where fraud was alleged?
Well, I mean, look, there's obviously something strange going on there.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, one can maybe look more really strong evidence that one has to be careful about those types of voting. You know, we had issues about observers being able to go and observe what was going on, and that shouldn't be the case. You shouldn't make it so difficult for people to be able to go and check those types of things.
Right.
And so, you know, my concern is the future. I don't want people to be fearful about the elections. But there's a reason why all these other countries have rules. You know, if concerns about fraud are a delusion, then it's a delusion shared by, you know, the rest
world.
Of the world.
Right.
It's not just a delusion that's shared by people in the United States. And so, you know, but one thing I also try to point out in the paper is that the interesting thing to me is that when you look at these other countries, there's agreement across the political spectrum in terms of having these anti-fraud rules. You look at Northern Ireland, for example. Margaret Thatcher, who was a conservative in 1985, implemented the first ID requirements for Northern Ireland voters. Tony Blair, who headed the Labour government in 2002, was concerned that the IDs were being counterfeited. And so what he did was he adopted a much more tamper-proof government-issued ID that was there. And, you know, I think he will claim that he was right, that there was maybe 11% of the people who were registered to vote in Northern Ireland weren't real people.
Huh.
And afterwards, there were some enterprising academics who talked to, like, the leader of Sinn Féin, a political party there, after the statute of limitations had run out. And he basically bragged about how they had whole armies of cab drivers ferrying people from one polling place to another, because basically the only way you could get caught is if you went to the same polling place multiple times.
Right.
They had printing presses that they had set up in order to create fake IDs for people. They had safe houses that people could go to change clothes and wigs and what have you when they went to go and vote from one place to another. You look at Mexico. All the parties in Mexico, all the three big parties at least there, all liked the 1992 anti-fraud reform. You know, and I'll just mention one other thing about Mexico, because people often talk about turnout rates. Not only did they adopt these IDs that we've just been talking about, but they also banned absentee ballots in 1992, completely banned them, whether you were living inside or outside the country. And then on top of that, what they did was they made it very difficult to get the IDs. You couldn't apply by mail. You had to go in person to go and apply for the voter ID. And then you had to go back a second time in order to go and pick it up. And the problem is that in almost all the Mexican states, there was only one registrar's office. So in some of those states, you may have to travel 75 miles each way in order to get your voter ID. Well, what do you think happened to voter turnout? Do you think it plummeted with making it so difficult and costly for people to go and get these IDs and requiring that they have to have these IDs? No, it soared. In the three presidential elections prior to 1992, the average voter turnout was 59%. In the three presidential elections afterwards, they had a voter turnout of 68%. So that's a 9 percentage point increase there.
Well, it's obvious why, because Mexican elections had been rigged ever since the revolution in 1860, and now it actually counted.
Your vote actually counted, whereas before...
Well,
and you look at here in Colorado, we have motor voter, right? So, I mean, if you register your car, whether you're here legally, illegally, whether you're, you know, have cars all over in every state in the country, you're just automatically registered and it's mailed to wherever your car, or to wherever that came in from, right?
How hard is it to do this analysis?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to, when I put the precinct level data together, I basically had to... sit down with a lot of maps to, because most counties just kind of have their own maps, and you have to link it in by hand with the counties next door. So you know, you have to look at the streets and kind of see which streets divide the different precincts, and kind of, because you know, sometimes you may have one precinct that's across the street from two, or you may have, you know, one to one or whatever. But you have to go, and it just took a lot of hours to get the maps and to go through and match the precincts. And then, of course, the precinct boundaries change between year to year, particularly between 2016 and 2020, because 2020 was such an unusual election in many places due to COVID that it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be fascinated if you had an extra hour or two. If you did a comparison of Denver and Boulder and the adjoining counties, because I have a feeling you'll see an enormous differential there too, where Donald Trump in 2016 lost by 4 points. In 2020, he lost by close to 15. And there's nothing in Colorado that would say that Donald Trump had suddenly all of a sudden gotten 10 points less popular. And so I really wonder.
Well, who knows? I mean, I haven't looked at that, so I can't really say. But
the same problems of Denver.
Yeah, no, it could very well be. I until I look at the data, I don't really want to say anything about it. But, look, there's no reason. I think there are real reasons why you should be cautious about mail-in votes. And there's a reason why virtually all the rest of the world, or the vast majority of the rest of the world, bans absentee ballots, completely bans them for people living in the country. You have more countries that allow for people living outside the country, but even about a third of Europe, for example, bans absentee ballots for people living outside the country. If you want to vote and you're living outside the country, then you have to go to either the embassy or a consulate, and then they'll have a little voting booth for you, and you can go and vote there. But, you have France, for example. France used to have absentee ballots like what we have. But what they discovered was that back in 1975, I guess some people had gotten a guilty conscience and went to the local prosecutors and said, look, we have hundreds of thousands of votes being bought on the island of Corsica. Wow. We have dead people that are doing... You know, one last point I'll just make, and that is I don't think people know the history of voting in the United States. We didn't have secret ballots until the first state to adopt secret ballots was Kentucky in 1882. The last state to move to secret ballots was South Carolina in 1950. And do you know that when states moved to secret ballots, that there was about a 12 percentage point drop in the rate that people voted? Do you know why? Because the way they used to do elections is you'd have a ballot box up in the front of the room, and you would take colored pieces of paper for your party, and you'd drop it in the box, and there would be a representative for each political party on either side of the box, and they would see how you voted.
Right.
And then they would pay you. And so when you move to secret ballots, they couldn't pay you for voting anymore because they couldn't be sure how you voted.
Right. Right.
And so the biggest problem is, when they were no longer getting paid for how they voted, didn't vote. And so you had this big drop in the rate that people voted. But because of that experience, because of that history, because people knew about all the vote buying that was occurring, that's the reason why we had a lot of the voting laws that we had, like banning absentee ballots or making them extremely restrictive, or going in banning things like ballot harvesting, those types of things. But as memory faded, as the decades went by and people kind of forgot the experience that we had had with things like vote buying, we gradually began to loosen up the rules on things like absentee ballots. Because absentee ballots and vote harvesting allow you to kind of go back and do the vote buying again. Somebody can go to your door, and they can pay you, and they can see right there how you're going to vote. They can verify
it. But you have one party
whose entire, virtually its entire existence has depended upon vote rigging. I mean, the Democratic Party, whether it's down south, where they prevented blacks from voting, or it was in places like Boston or New York, where I'm from, which is an enormous amount of crooked voting. I mean, your average Democrat thinks any restriction...
It's
voter suppression. And I've worked in nonpartisan campaigns with volunteers from both parties. And the Democrats, you had to stop them from cheating. You go, no, you can't cheat. What do you mean we can't cheat? Of course we can cheat. We're supposed to cheat. We're Democrats. And so, you have just a minimal restrictions imposed by Georgia. I'm not sure the restrictions, but slight tightening. And all of a sudden...
Let's talk about the big brouhahas last year. So you have Georgia. What were people so upset about? What they were upset about was Georgia wanted to require that people had to put the last four digits of their Social Security number on their absentee ballots. Well, here's the thing. All Americans have a Social Security number. It's not a question of whether you go and apply for it or not. In fact, many non-Americans have Social Security numbers. And so, and presumably everybody knows their Social Security number. They're going to get Social Security checks at one point in their life, and most people have it memorized, surely the last four digits, anyway, of their Social Security number. Obviously, that was the end of the world. That was Jim Crow, too, to go and require that a number that everybody has have the last four digits be put on it. What got everybody so upset in Texas? Well, the reason why the Democrats walked out of the state house there was because of these ballot boxes in Harris County, Texas, which is Houston.
Right.
Republicans wanted to have a rule that said you could only leave the ballot boxes out between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. So it's basically 16 hours during the day you could leave them out, and you had to monitor them when they were left out. I cannot find another country in the world that doesn't have strict chain of custody rules with regard to ballot boxes. Every other country in the world, they don't even think about this type of stuff because they want to make sure that the person who puts the ballot in the ballot box is the person whose name is on the ballot.
Well, neither U.S. corporations nor the Democratic Party want that.
That's just so.
They can't cheat the election, and because they love cheating, it's in their DNA, and Republicans are so squeamish to even make the most basic ones, and when they do, the Democrats either buy in the all-star game from your state or all of a sudden all the legislators leave the state.
They crack down. Hey, listen, John, we've got to let you go. Where can people, because this is a great report, can people go and take a look at it?
Well, it's on our website at crimeresearch.org. And we have a lot of other type of information on vote fraud and voting rules in other countries. If you click the little link there that says vote fraud, you'll see all the different reports and stuff that we put out too. Beyond the paper in Public Choice is right at the top of the page, though.
All right. So thank you for doing this, number one. And also just thank you for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Great report.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye. That's Dr. John Lott Jr. there, crimeresearch.org. Well, you're absolutely right. There's a reason that the Democrats are pushing all of these things. They have essentially no rules, right? And that's because their ideas are so awful that no one would vote for them. But now I want to talk about a little bit an election that was done right. Okay. Anil Mathai, the chair of CD7, was kind of tweeting there because he had colored envelopes or colored pieces of paper for the voting. He said he didn't pay for that. I was going to ask you, Anil, did we miss getting paid for our vote? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But wanted to bring up, I think I saw him enter the Zoom room, Jimmy Mack. Jimmy, if you're there, voila. I see you. Hey, Jimmy, thank you for your time today. How you doing? We spent a lot of time together Saturday, huh?
Yes, we did. And I appreciate you and Chuck having me back on your show. Every time you're gracious enough to invite me to your show, I always have the exact same two thoughts. First of all, I'd love to go back on their show. And secondly, I wonder who canceled.
We revamped the show today. Our producer Anil Mathai wanted because there are a couple of reasons. Because one, I think this is pertinent for the state assembly coming up. But can you explain? Because you're not in CD8, right? But you were part of the committee that helped to count the votes. There were some roughly 400 delegates there. I think maybe not quite 400.
I think that's right. Yes.
And so we voted for various CD8 positions, like on Board of Regents, Board of Education, and then Congress. You had no dog in this race, right? You were just there as part of an impartial person to help do the counting. Why don't you explain to folks how it worked and then how it went?
Okay, very good. I just feel like you said, Julie, it went really well. And I think the whole thing went well because of the way it was designed. Right. Anil Mathai, the new chairman of CD8, and I'm sure most or all of your viewers and listeners are aware that this was a very historic a congressional assembly, because this was the very, very first assembly ever for this brand new congressional district. And Anil Mathai is the newly elected chairman of the newly created eighth congressional district. And by design, he wanted to invite people to be part of the teller committee who were kind of outsiders, as it were, people that he knew and people that he knew he could trust. But they were also, in his words, people that didn't have skin in the game. They didn't want to have, you know, people from who were working on a certain candidate campaign.
Right.
Yes. You know, and so I will tell you, I was not the chairman of the teller committee. I was the vice chairman. Peg Cage. I will give 100% of credit to Peg Cage for coming up with this simple but 100% effective way of counting the votes.
Right. This this was a paper ballot, and it was counted there. There were no machines. There was no anything.
No clickers.
No Dominion machines.
Exactly.
It was a paper ballot, and there were a bunch of races, and we had a time limit, and it all got done on time. And so, go ahead.
Well, I call it the, for lack of a better term, the glass box method of voting, because from the time you filled out your ballot, and it's like you said, we had a different color ballot, for a paper ballot for every race. We had, I think, three different races, and we were prepared to do others if there was like a runoff or whatever. But so you didn't know when you walked in as a delegate, you didn't know which color ballot was going to be used. Anil announced that from the podium.
Just before the voting.
And so from the moment you cast your ballot, let's say for Congress, you wanted to vote for Jane Doe for Congress. You wrote that name down and you personally by hand put this in. I call it a glass box. To be fair, it was a plastic transparent box and you could see inside of it. And that never, ever, ever left the eyesight, the view of the audience.
Well, and then he had one other thing too, what you guys did, because what they did is they had the boxes were there, and then there were people from the teller, the counting committee, basically standing there, and you verified that everybody who was voting was a legitimate voter. They had to have a badge.
That's correct.
When you checked in. And so
that's correct.
Even if somebody had a bunch of color coded cards, I mean, you still had to have the badge. So you verified.
You had to be a good cheater.
You had to, yeah.
Yeah. I don't, honestly, I don't know how you would cheat. I really don't. Yeah. The little cherry on the ice cream float here was that the teller committee didn't then take these boxes of ballots off into another room away from everybody's sight. These were immediately carried up onto the stage. This was an auditorium full of delegates, and they saw every single thing that the teller committee did. And as we were counting these ballots and tallying up the totals, it was on stage. Everyone saw everything we did.
How many counters did you have?
We had three tables of six. So that would be.
How'd you count the ballots? I mean,
we took the big boxes from the audience, from the delegates, and the contents of each of those were separated just by hand into smaller glass boxes that you could still see through. And we had teams of people. We had teams of three people. The middle person was pulling out one ballot at a time, and he would say, John Smith. And so the person to his right and the person to his left would each put a tally mark for John Smith. He would then pull out another. This is Mary Jones. So they would each give a tally mark to Mary Jones. At the end, hypothetically, theoretically, these two numbers will match. If they didn't, we did the whole process over again. And so it was just a very simple matter of mathematics to add them all up.
We've got some questions here, so let me answer. So Sandra's like, verified by driver's license. No, Sandra, the way it worked is, in order to be a delegate, you had to be a registered voter, a registered Republican, and then you got a badge that verified that you were a delegate. And
well, you had to be elected a delegate.
You had to be elected. But I mean, it was, so you didn't need your driver's license. You'd already been elected the delegate. You did have to show your driver's license, though, when you checked in, I guess
to get your badge. You did.
And then Peg, for folks who don't want to know, Peg put the instructions on a website. And I see, and then Dr. Downey, you've got a question, and Peg is going to come on here in about 2 minutes and make that announcement. So Peg also has an announcement. But Jimmy, here's the thing too.
Just let me go back. How long did it take you to count each of the tabulations?
It honestly didn't take long because of the numbers. Now, if this process were to be done, let's say, for instance, this coming Saturday at the state assembly, clearly we would have to have a larger team of people, but we were on stage literally counting these ballots while Anil was conducting his business from the podium, and it didn't take too long. There was a couple of times he had to kind of stretch and kill some time. I think there was one time he asked.
Even if he did, I mean, you could. How many counters did you have?
I would say 18. And then we had two or three others that were walking around kind of watching and supervising.
Well, and let me point out too, each of the candidates also could have people go up, and I saw many of them did, and stand there and watch the counting.
So yes, ma'am. Very good point. Very good point. Yes.
The candidates could go and
well, it could be just as fast. And it really took about 7-10 minutes is what it took.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And, you know, you could have exactly the same amount of time if you had 10 times the amount, because you're going to have 10 times the voters down the thing. Or it could take 20 minutes, which wouldn't be bad at all, if you had five times the number. But in either way, you know, there are lots of people willing to help with the counting, and it just seems amazing that the Republican Party is always trying to get us used to whatever the Democrats
want. Well, and in the meantime, too, I imagine that those slips of paper, so if a candidate had a question, and they're like, I just can't believe I lost by that much, or whatever, they could come back and they could, I'm assuming, say, let me see, right? And I mean, it's all right there, right?
They could today or tomorrow or next week or whenever.
So I'm assuming that Anil probably then preserved those, unlike we've had other times in the Colorado Republican Party where like, our dog ate them, or we threw them away. We don't have them anymore. So
that's right.
They were thrown out 12 seconds after the vote.
That's right. All right, thank you for coming on. You can stay on if you want, but I want, because Dr. Donna, Peg Cage, I saw come on. too. Peg, if you're there, if you want to unmute yourself and bring your
loveliness up.
Loveliness up. So
there she is.
First, because we've only got
how are you guys?
We're good. We're good. We got about 8 minutes left, so there's time. So number one, congratulations on this system. But secondly, I want to talk about, because, you know, this was the way it was done. It was done right. We were talking with John Lott Jr. before, you know, who has raised some questions about elections nationally. But Peg, you are a denier. That's what you're saying. You're a denier, a denier, a denier.
Probably.
All of the deniers are going to have a debate tonight.
Yes,
inquiring minds want to know. Why don't you tell us about that real quick?
So tonight, I had been to just a presentation with Colonel Sean Smith talking about the lack of integrity of our elections. And it was at a place where Matt Crane was also present. And after Sean Smith told his qualifications for making the claims that he was making, and he claimed exactly what he had seen as he was doing his research, Matt Crane came from the back of the room, and he was the former county clerk of Arapahoe County, and then he is the current executive director, right, of the County Clerks Association.
Colorado. And his wife, by the way, either currently or at least used to work for Dominion Voting System.
Sure.
Subsidiary.
Sure.
Okay.
Just sure. Go. He's good friends with Wayne Williams, and they were in on the changing the definition of ballots cast so that they could pretend that the numbers in equals the numbers out, because it's the county clerk who actually cast your ballots, not you. So anyway, Matt Crane was yelling from the back of the room that Sean Smith was, an election denier or whatever, and that that we have redundancies in the system, so there wouldn't be any kind of way for anybody to commit any kind of fraud. So Sean Smith said, hey, I challenge you to a debate anytime, anywhere. And that is what I put together for tonight. And I just got word from Matt Crane that he will not be in attendance because the time for debate is over. And
it's over. Oh,
there you go.
You
there you
deniers.
Go. For debate is over. I love that.
The time for debate. Over because you stupid deniers keep coming up with evidence. And so we don't want to debate it. It's not that the time for debate is over because it's been settled. The time for debate is over because there are questions about it. Well, that's right. One way to win a debate. I try to do that with Chuck. I'm like, Chuck, the time for debate is over.
It's over. He says, if there's any evidence of fraud or wrongdoing, we encourage you, Sean, or others, to provide it to law enforcement so that a real investigation should happen.
Oh, I know. Oh, so we can send it to Phil Weiser, the
Phil
state
Weiser,
AG.
Yeah.
He'll get right on it. Well, maybe Jenna Griswold.
Jenna Griswold.
The partisan hack secretary.
Even though talking to Jenna Griswold is a crime.
Right. And actually, you're absolutely right there. If you were to try to present this to Phil Weiser under the new bill they're trying to present to vote, you would then be arrested on scene, on site, for presenting it in place. That kind of sums it up all right there. This is what I say to any of you people who don't want to have any questions about the election, come to a debate. Just hear it. We're wrong, if you have answers to the questions we're asking, answer them. And then we'll say, okay, I guess we do have the gold standard. Or if not, then maybe you could say, well, maybe there are some questions. So.
Right. Well, so tonight we will have Colonel Sean Smith and Data Jeff will be there, and they will answer the questions that Matt brought up in his letter to the General Assembly. And they will just bring forward the problems the county clerks are asking for proof. We'll give it tonight. And there you go. The information about the webs about the debate is at mycoloradogop.org. There's a link there to see the debate live streamed at 7. And if you are in the Greeley area and you want to come and see it in person, you can, at this point, you're going to have to, just email me. It's reclaim@mycoloradogop.org. and do it quick because I'm going to head up to Greeley here pretty soon. they're going to have food at 5, and then we're going to have the debate starting right at 7.
So just to clarify, so folks understand, so what happened is there have been some people in Colorado who have been raising questions and presenting what they consider to be evidence right. supporting the asking of the questions. Right. At a recent meeting, Matt Crane, who's a rhino
extraordinaire,
basically was at the debate.
Kind.
Well, shouting out questions. So everybody, so Sean Smith said, okay, fine, let's have a debate. You right. set up the debate. And then today, right. mere hours before the debate, Matt Crane said he's not going to show up to debate because there is no ability. There's nothing to debate. Right.
Time for debate is over.
Debate is over.
Time for crooking the next election is now.
We're too busy. That's right.
It's now. Hey, yeah, Sandra asked, are you going to tape it and have it available at My Colorado GP?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh,
My
yes.
Colorado GP. Now, have you had any of those county clerks who had that outraged, horrified news conference yesterday saying, bring us the evidence? Have any of them called up to say, hey, what is this debate or how can I watch it? Or has any of them contacted you to try to get some of the evidence that they said there is none of?
Well, Julie, I'm going to say no, but I'm going to give that I give them grace because I did not specifically send it to all of the county clerks. I sent the invitation to every one of the people in the General Assembly who got Matt Crane's original letter so that they could have the answers to his questions and they could attend if they wanted.
Well, that's great. Perfect. That's
all
super.
Right. Peg, thank you. And thank you also though. That
you
was...
know, Peg, I'll just say this live, you know, we should try to, everybody wants funds, but we should try to raise a little money to get John Lott Jr. to do analysis, the similar analysis that he did
in some of those other states
and look at Colorado.
And see.
Because I think you'd find the same
sure.
Kind of patterns. Well, sure. and again,
we're raising money for the lawsuit and we have right. our first hearing tomorrow. So I'd
that's right. Yes. That could be, that's the opt-out law. So we'll report on, there's so much we're going to have to expand our show.
I know. And the rally at the Capitol.
Exactly. There's
a great rally there. And Mike Lindell will be there, won't he?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Now real quick then from when is that and where is that and how can people find out about
that? It's at noon at the Capitol. And I think you'll have to go on America's Mom to find out about that. I just, okay. with the thing on Saturday, I haven't had time to
you've been a little busy. Okay. Sandra's saying Sharona Bishop will be there
well.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for all that you do. Thank you for designing a great voting system in CDA.
No, I thought it was a great coup to show. You know, it isn't that hard to count by.
It's not. It was Robert's Rules of Order and the Taiwan system. I had a guy from Taiwan call me and tell me that's how they did it. So.
Well, and I think in a great thanks to Anil Mathai.
Absolutely.
Who set that all up.
Transparency.
And he put on here, he was listening and says he preserves the votes. Wait, he preserves the votes for a year. Yeah. So what a concept.
And
right?
a lot of thanks to me.
Yes.
Because one guy came up and said, where are these interlopers, these non-CDA people doing being our teller committee? How dare they? And I got up and defended everybody. So we got an overwhelming vote for the teller committee.
Oh, hey, and real quick, I want to see Cody LeBlanc, who made it on. Thank you. I'm glad you're listening, Cody. Thank you. We may have to have you back on, Cody. Just so you know, contact me. You've got an open invitation for state board. Right.
Yeah,
he made
yeah.
it onto the ballot. He is yes. listening and says, yes, thank you, Anil. So, Cody, anytime you want to come on, you're welcome to come on our show. We're out of time, though, now. Thank you, Peg. Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you, John Lott, the great guys at BBS.
He's great. His dad is wonderful.
Yes.
Yep.
And thank you, all the listeners
right.
and people. And we'll have a full report on Wednesday.
That's right. And hey, everybody know, just you can always catch the podcast, all the links to whatever your podcast choice. You can go to Rumble or to chuckandjulie.com is the best way. And we'll see you all on Wednesday.
Take care.
See you guys then.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.